So I'm just.
But they needed the isotopes to get at the structure of the atom.
Yeah.
To get
at
they couldn't understand why there were slight differences.
But that was. I really think we're going to get some nice celebrations next year. I hope so, anyway, because I think it's an important, important development. Well, I've turned on the magic machine here, so we're once again recording.
Okay.
This is the April the 14th, Saturday. We've had an enjoyable time in the Baltimore area, and we're going to continue, well, hopefully more or less where we left off. And I'm thinking, did we get... I know that when you came to the College Park campus, you once again had to come here without any equipment. Is that correct?
Well, without mass spectrometers.
Without any mass spectrometers.
Yeah. But my startup there, you're always interested in how people obtain their instruments.
Yes.
My startup for making the move included acquisition of a big instrument.
Okay.
The instrument we got was Applied Biosciences QTOF.
Ah, all right.
And
so this would have been the late 90s?
This was, yes, in 98.
And so you're abandoning the traditional sector machines,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah. I'm proud to say College Park has a sector instrument right now. It's a smaller instrument, but it still gives good high resolution, and I can show my students what a sector looks like. Bought to support the synthetic chemistry.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's still a place for that equipment. It's just the big push for biological applications has moved these other instruments to the fore, and because they're so much more effective in solving the problem or addressing the problems. So you got this. This was the BSIX machine, or was it the QTOF?
It was a pulsar.
Oh, okay.
Something. And then, because of the bacteria work, we were funded to buy a MALDI-TOF, and also an AP MALDI-TOF. AP MALDI ion trap.
Okay, so this was the atmospheric
pressure
ionization.
Ionization.
Yeah. So that's really different than chemical ionization, but it's kind of similar to it.
I think that's fair.
And that development came primarily out of Canada, didn't it? In Applied Biosystems, people, SciEx, or you know, I mean, it's kind of I have a good sense of where chemical ionization came from,
well,
but I have a much
the atmospheric pressure MALDI was commercialized by SESI, the company. In Columbia, Maryland.
Okay.
And I think that it was probably brought to them by a Russian.
Oh, okay.
So it came out of Russian physics.
Ah, all right. But it's become a pretty popular ionization technique for in more recent times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this gets you enough to get some graduate students in your. Research started. Now, are you still looking for postdocs as lieutenants, or?
Yeah. So I still had I brought serious NIH funding and DARPA funding, and then the FBI funding came on board very fast. And so I had a couple of the senior people in my lab helped me move, make the move. It's hard, you know, that's serious. We actually had a Fourier transform ICR instrument at UMBC, which had been bought for the bacteria work by DARPA. It had a DARPA property tag on it, so we were able to move that. And I forgot to say that. And I was really quite amazed that you can wheel a Fourier transform ICR into a moving van, drive it down the highway and wheel it off the moving van, and it works. It's pretty robust as long as you keep it cold.
So that
was moved very
easily. So
this
was a Supercon magnet instrument?
Yeah, and it was shielded.
Really cool.
So we were able to set it up without too much trouble.
Did, you obviously talked to someone about what he thought that was the thing to do.
Well, Bob, we bought it from Bob McIver's company,
sure.
IonSpec, and
yeah.
They actually flew out and did the move for us.
Okay.
But subsequently, I mean, after we saw how easy it was, we did give that instrument up eventually because it was very good for phospholipids, which we were interested in at the time, but not very good for proteins,
uh-huh.
and so, or even peptides. So we moved it on. We gave it to Peter O'Connor, who was in Boston at the time, and he came down in a moving van and moved it himself without the IonSpec support this time.
That's interesting.
Uh-huh.
I never thought of doing anything like that, but if you can, it's a lot better than warming up the magnet and quenching all, getting rid of all the helium and nitrogen and everything else. That's pretty amazing. Yeah, that's great. So now you've got some graduate students, some postdocs, and some equipment, and mm-hmm. you're off and running. And you're, mm-hmm. there's this kind of a long history, I think over a period of a decade or more, of this bacterial kind of work that I saw on your publications. It's not like it's something that's really focused on for a short period of time intensely, but it's, you keep coming back to it. Is that kind of a fair
assessment? Every time the mass spectrometry technology improves, we look at bacteria again to see if it's better.
Mm-hmm.
So as I mentioned, that our first paper was in 1975, and then we revisited it in the 80s and 90s with phospholipids, and in the 90s and the 2000s with where we were looking at proteins
mm-hmm.
and peptides.
So this guy, there's some work on cactus in here, is that, or is it, did I misread that there's this business with these particular bacteria that I think are so, the bacillus spores, I guess that's the stuff with the anthrax, amerithrax or whatever.
That's the first cousin,
Bacillus
anthracis is the cousin. We did some work with the veterinarian vaccine strain of Bacillus anthracis, which is not lethal to cows or people, but it does help to develop immunity.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, from my point of view, they were available as a really good compound to practice our techniques on, demonstrate our techniques on, without having to have a special biohazard facility.
Yeah. Well, that's a serious issue, getting into the dealing mm-hmm. with some of these, I don't know what you call them, biohazardous type materials.
The student newspaper, got a little wind of this and wanted to know all about our work. We told them that we had nothing that would infect people in our lab. All my students swore to that. Well, all the students were keenly aware of that, too.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that there's signage that kind of encourages people not to enter your wing of the building.
That precedes my move there.
Uh-huh.
It's got nothing to do with my research. I think it was that the undergraduates were, unassociated people were going to be a nuisance.
Just keep out the riffraff, kind of, so to speak.
Maybe it's the engineers we were trying to keep out. I don't know. But that preceded me.
So, in addition to going revisiting the bacteria work, what other kind of things were you doing then at the College Park?
Well, we started, we developed this 018 labeling method that I mentioned briefly yesterday. In the early, I would say we were into proteomics from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Got, and our NIH funding came through for proteomics projects. The people were looking for isotope methods so we can do quantitative comparisons, and we put this 018 method into the literature. We've worried a lot about protein fractionation, published methods on that. We've also, as everybody else in proteomics, we began to become more interested in bioinformatics. How do we compare our mass spectra to the gene mm-hmm. sequence, the databases of sequences, and how do we know how good our identifications are, and that sort of thing. And I found that I did open the collaboration with Nathan Edwards, who was on our campus at that time. Nathan had a PhD in mathematics from Cornell, and mm-hmm. His first job was with Celera, and Celera had just I guess as when he was there, they finished the human genome sequence, and they had decided to try to work in proteomics next. So mm-hmm. they hired a number of really bright mathematicians to work on the bioinformatics, how do you turn a mass spectrum into a tandem mass spectrum into a peptide sequence into a protein identification, and mm-hmm. he was one of those. And they didn't do he stayed there 4 years. He certainly learned a lot about mass spectrometry. You know, protein mass spectrometry based bioinformatics is different from genomics, because genomics usually use actually identification of a base of the nucleoside base to do the searching, mm-hmm. and we have to use, or most efficiently use our raw mass spectra mm-hmm. to do the searching. But anyway, he was an expert in that, and the team of, I don't know, 8 mathematicians at Celera had working on it were all dispersed all over the country. They've all remained in touch, and they're still doing a good job of moving bioinformatics forward. Anyway, Nathan started to collaborate with us, and so one of the neatest things, I think, papers I published from College Park was a series of papers where we demonstrated that we could identify proteins from bacteria that did not have sequenced genomes by looking at the proteins in a broader set of bacteria. The first cousins, if you like, mm-hmm. had a lot of proteins that were very similar, and so that's moved things forward a little too. Now there's still lots of great bacteria challenges, but this is the idea that we could identify proteins mm-hmm. without the genome was mm-hmm. a shortcut.
And yeah, well, I mean, that's any of these things are important to the hello. moving the field forward, and it's moving in various at a speed that's
yes.
sometimes too fast, sometimes not fast enough.
Yeah.
I think the problem, and I think it's pretty well known now, is that the informatics, that whole mm-hmm. side of the problem has just gotten a little bit out of hand. I mean, the amount of data that can be acquired is way in excess of
what we can handle.
How it can be analyzed
yeah.
easily. And I mean, is that a fair assessment of the state of the
sure.
world today?
Yeah, that's right. I agree.
And I don't know if anyone has any brilliant ideas about how they can do that analysis. I mean, it's fortunately we have people that are attacking the problem.
Yeah. Well, the other challenge is to keep the protein identifications related to their biological functions.
Ah.
And that, of course, really that talked about the the cross-disciplinary need to work with bioinformaticists, but we also have to work with cell biologists who might have a clue about what it all means.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
A lot of the some laboratories think that when you make a identification by a mass spectrum, you should also confirm it with a antibody blot or with a functional study of the cells or the animals.
So a kind of a traditional biological,
yeah,
this reminds me of the situation that Klaus Biemann faced when he tried to publish in JAX the structure of this whatever it was, the first thing that he was started
yes.
working on, and
yes.
the editor-in-chief came back and says, well, you know, you need to do melting points on this good stuff. So it sounds like there's a similar kind
sure.
of a worldview disconnect
yes.
between
yes.
mass spec people and biologists. And
right. And it probably is not necessary to do a biological confirmation on every protein. But the ones that are really interesting, the ones that you know, that might be potentially important, need to be
mm-hmm.
followed up with
mm-hmm.
biology. You know, another disconnect was when the organic synthetic people started using accurate mass for elemental analysis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a couple of famous papers showing that the combustion analysis gave the wrong analysis,
mm-hmm.
and of course the high resolution molecular mass, particularly these small molecules, or smaller molecules,
yeah,
could match with the correct analysis.
Yeah.
I remember that one of the editors of associate editors of Tetrahedron came and talked to me for a while about how reliable that was, and should Tetrahedron expand its requirements for elemental analysis to include. And now, of course, all of those products are characterized by accurate mass measurement.
Sure, yeah.
And there's very little combustion analysis.
Yeah, and it's just the same with regard to structure determination. You know, I mean, so much can be done, well, particularly with NMR now, mm-hmm. and mass spec between the two and infrared. It's just, those other methods from wet chemical days are just really have gone by the by, but justifiably so. That is something, I mean, do you feel like, we're thinking on this topic, do you think that the analytical community is considered to be less than scientifically worthy by their other chemical colleagues? That seems to be an attitude that I've found in places, and also the attitude that schools have towards having programs in analytical chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
definitely it's a problem there. Probably and the pattern I see most clearly is that the private schools like Hopkins don't offer analytical, though there's a lot of analytical chemistry done in their faculties, and that the state schools have maintained that responsibility because they know that students will get jobs, students will help local industry. Analytical students mm-hmm. are useful. So the the powerhouses in analytical chemistry are state universities. I will note that Dick Zehr on occasion calls himself an analytical chemist. He's at Stanford, and that George Whiteside at Harvard on occasion calls himself an analytical chemist. And I also note that Fred McLaverty, who you and I would think is an analytical chemist, announced himself as an organic chemist in CNE News a few years ago.
Oh, really? He's abandoning the field again.
I think he got some pushback on that, and then he recanted and decided that he'd stay an analytical chemist.
Yes, right. I don't think he can get away with that.
Yeah.
Maybe with people who don't know much about Fred he can, but So your work pretty much has been continuing up to the present time then in this vein. And I'm getting the impression with the improvement in instrumentation you're also able to do better on the bacteria side of things and dealing with trying to make more and more sense out of the analysis of these guys.
Well, in the rapid time frame, I mean, you can chop up a bacterium and do just straight biochemistry on it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are doing beautiful work that way with mass spectrometry, but for our rapid analysis, sure, better instruments is always a better measurement. I've been interested in small portable instruments, and this company, SESI, and also the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab have both fielded small MALDI TOFs that allowed our approach to be demonstrated in a open air releases.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of leads to the idea about the commercial development of ideas. Are you involved in that in any way? Or
not at the moment. Have been a couple times. I have 5 patents,
mm-hmm.
But I'm not doing anything like that right now.
Okay, and these patents are, I saw a couple of them when I did the sci-fi research, there were a few in there, that are related primarily to analytical techniques? Or
yeah, I think there's one instrumental patent which also has Bob's name on it.
Mm, okay.
But I have not gotten rich from my patents.
Well, yeah, that's another. It's I'm not sure that anyone does. I mean, I guess some people do, but
yeah,
I think one person I think that I know is Frisch, Eugene Frisch, this fellow that because so much of his chemistry goes into the fabrication of microcircuits and whatnot. So I think he's fairly well off from the proceeds in that patent. It'd be interesting to do somebody to do a an analysis of how much, you know, I'm sure there's a spike of a handful of people who make a living on their patents, and the rest of the patents count for next to nothing.
Well, there was a time when I thought that, recently, in fact, that having the first paper out did not guarantee that you would be identified as the person who thought of this idea, that you actually had to have the patent to be clearly identified as the as the inventor or the person who had the idea. I don't know, maybe that's easing a little bit, but it certainly does tie the case up legally about who went there first.
Was speaking about priority, it's interesting because when I interviewed Bill Knowles, who was a Nobel laureate in chemistry, he was and working at Monsanto, and he spent his whole life at Monsanto. And he was, the work that he did, they actually ended up, you know, being awarded the prize for, was he ensured that it got in the literature as soon as possible, and actually it was subverting some of the internal pathways that you have to go through in industry to get publications out. And he recognized that this work was, I don't think he wanted, you know, whoever thought he'd get a Nobel Prize for it. But he realized that it was important work, and he wanted to make sure that it was in the literature quickly. And so he actually went around some of the internal review cycles in Monsanto to get it in the literature right away, which I think stood him in good stead, because he did get the Nobel Prize for it, really. But he was aware of that, of the primacy. And that is, I think, one of the big things of the Nobel Prize is having the first. You got to be able to show that you're the first and defensively or through the literature.
Well, as I understand it, that's why Tanaka got the prize and not Helmkamp.
Yeah. I don't know what the difference in time was between their various developments.
Probably several years.
Really? Okay.
Well, I think I told you, didn't I, that Karas published a report in Analytical Chemistry that said that they learned about Tanaka's success at a conference and went home and rebuilt their instrument. Because they weren't doing the post-acceleration.
The post-acceleration.
Yeah. So that's not my view, but it's Karas's of Helmkamp and Karas' view also.
Well, that has definitely been a big factor in the rush to biological applications of mass spectrometry, and definitely worthy of note by the larger scientific community. There was something in here I read where you looked at a cockroach or
a
bug, or what was that? Some kind of a strange bug.
I call bugs bacteria bugs.
Bacteria.
I may have said bugs when I really meant bacteria.
Oh, okay. I thought it was okay. Oh, you're using it.
And viruses. We looked at viruses too.
Yeah. So how does that work? The viral study of viruses with mass spectrometry.
Well, we tried to do it pretty much like we did the bacteria, that we tried to desorb intact, dissolve the virus and desorb intact proteins. And of course, viruses. There's even, well, as with the bacteria, we chose models, organisms to study that were not harmful to people, and I have not yet had an arrangement, which would have to be some kind of collaboration, where I could work with the viruses of greater interest, those that are harmful to people. We did some of our bacteria work in collaboration with people at the Army Laboratory at Frederick, Maryland.
Okay.
And then after 9/11, we were no longer allowed access to the biological laboratory in Frederick.
Oh my! Yeah.
So I need to find a virology collaborator to develop the rapid mass spectrometry method.
All right. So what do you do to prepare viruses for mass spectrometry?
Well, we tried to put them in acid and see if they would disintegrate and release their proteins. You know, the most abundant protein in a virus is usually the protein that forms its outside shell.
Okay.
And you can tell a lot about the virus from the molecular weight of that protein. But you have to get, there's usually like several hundred of those that are tightly bound together, and you have to get them to come apart. And so we have to lyse the virus, mm-hmm. open, mm-hmm. denature the virus, and that can be done chemically. But we have, as I say, we have probably some proof of concept out in that area, but haven't found the right circumstance to develop it, mm-hmm. fully.
And then, once you've gotten the shell kind of in the phase where you can study it, you just use standard. So are these fairly high mass proteins or?
Well, of course, the ones that are easiest to see are the ones that aren't high mass.
Ah, yeah.
and so the our virus has been most studied. It's called MS2, and its coprotein, I think, weighs about 13,000, so it's amenable to all the ToF analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, that's the old mass range problem, which we don't have any...
mass range versus sensitivity.
So I'm always confused, or there's always these papers in the literature of people saying that they're working at high mass. The problem with that, a rather soft way of describing it, is that high mass changes with time.
That's right.
So I wish they'd say the mass range that they're, what constitute as high, because going back historically, it's not so easy.
Well, we were asking me about what we're doing at College Park, and I guess I would say the most recently we've opened the idea of identifying proteins. Intact proteins, which people like to call top-down analysis, and in fact, when we looked at the proteins from bacteria with no genome, those were top-down analyses, introducing the lysing the bacteria, introducing that mixture through the LC into the orbit trap, and also activating the protein for decomposition, so that the intact protein breaks into pieces. It's not quite as thoroughly as an intact peptide is broken. Mm-hmm. There is some good software that was written by Neil Kelleher's lab.
Okay.
It's now commercially available that interprets the top-down spectra, these tandem spectra of collisionally activated or otherwise activated larger proteins, intact proteins.
So yeah, he comes out of the Fred McLafferty school, right, Neil?
Probably, yeah.
For the top-down thing. So what about the drift work? Are you doing any of that?
No, I'd love to get into that, but we haven't found a problem that was compelling enough to request the funding.
That's a whole other instrumentation area that... probably without the requirements, analytical requirements of biological work, would probably not have been advanced so well.
It just
seems to be, it's almost like the old days of GCMS where it first got together and everybody wants to do this because it's so powerful. But
I don't know if it's quite there yet. There's still only three companies that offer it. Waters, Agilent. Agilent just hasn't sold one yet. They've just announced.
Really? Okay. VG is into that, I think.
Okay.
Is it VGNR? I can't even keep up with.
That's Waters, actually.
Waters.
Yeah, and that's a nice instrument, and I agree with you. There's some very interesting. There's some.
What
do
they
biological.
Call that? No, the Waters thing. I can't think of the phrase. You know, they got a little catchphrase for it, but it's basically it's a drift.
Ion mobility.
Mass spec thing. Mm-hmm. The data that's produced by those things is pretty amazing. It actually looks like it might be one of the first ways to deal with some of this huge volume of information that comes out of these very...
Well, it can also be viewed as another separation technique.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
And then still relying on the final mass spectrum for the real identification.
It is, the technology just doesn't sit still.
Yeah, that's why it's so fun.
And I'm glad I'm not in the instrument business because you're never mean, it's like being under the gun every year to keep up with what's going on.
One of the reasons I like ASMS is that it's going to be that little poster in the corner that you didn't see that actually is going to excite the next revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of these people?
Sure.
Give me a list of people.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about Gerasi already.
Yeah.
I've told you a couple of Beeman stories. I've talked a little bit about Burlingame.
But I was thinking about this. You are coming into this and really high-powered environment.
At Hopkins, you mean?
Well, even back in your when you worked for Gerasi.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I would assume that by this time he was pretty well recognized as a.
Yes, and the lab was full of foreign postdocs,
yeah,
right?
So
right.
I mean, were you intimidated at all by this being introduced to this really high-powered chocolate mix of?
No, you know, that was what I went to graduate school for, was to move to the state of the art of chemistry. Gerasi took several students from my incoming graduate class, so there were colleagues there as well.
Okay, and this was an active, intentional thing on your part to try and get into his group. Or?
No, he actually invited me.
Okay,
it's kind of. You know, these are like big mixers. How do graduate students choose get their masters with professors?
Sure.
It's like a big social mixer, but the graduate student has to have heads up to, you know, get into an area where there's a career ahead of them. Mm-hmm. The professors think they need to be able to choose the productive graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I probably did not know what mass spectrometry was before I went to graduate school, because it really was so new.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very active in bringing new techniques into his natural products lab. He also brought 2D, no, brought thin layer chromatography in during the very first year I was there.
Hmm.
And it's hard to believe there wasn't thin layer chromatography, but, you know, he picked it up somewhere probably in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And was as thorough in getting the experts in to teach us how and introducing that to the lab as he was with the mass spectrometry.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
So what other things you were going to talk about Gerasi a little bit more? You have any nice anecdotes?
No, he was a terrific lab manager. I think I also did say yesterday you could always get an appointment with him. He had weekly meetings.
Mm-hmm. He separated his two worlds.
Yeah, so admirably. And at the time, I didn't appreciate that, but now I do.
Mm-hmm.
He made considerable effort to keep the lab clean. We did not have dishwashers. We did not have technicians.
Mm-hmm.
We all were supposed to wash our own dishes. And for a while, he would have a Friday afternoon inspection. You either had to hide your dirty dishes or wash them. I think that he finally let go of that. But but you know, I learned a lot about how to run a lab from being in his lab.
Well, it's easy. I mean, particularly for some people, it's easy to turn a lab into a super mess.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, my students, the people who've gone through my lab, many of them run their groups also with weekly. Mm-hmm. Group meetings and some of the things they learned from me, you know, some of which I learned from Gerasi. So I have great admiration for the man. He's managed to, you know, become famous for a lot of things since, but it's like chemistry.
Yeah. So do you see him anymore? I mean, run into him on occasion or whatever?
Yeah, Bob and I had dinner in a group of 30 with him in March of 2011 in Washington, D.C., and his son and his grandson were there. His brother was there. it was a nice social event.
Occasionally you do run into him and he still knows who you are.
Yes, he does. He usually sends me an email when I get an award or something. So he also...
He's aware of...
He's reading CNE News, I think, which is cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think CNE News is really good. It's probably one of the best... sources of information about chemistry that there is estimation.
Definitely.
So he's still a good guy. He's still alive. He's getting in up there.
I think he's more than 90. Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay. So because he had already been in industry when he went back to academe, and you met up with him in your career. Okay. All right. Who else is next that you wanted to spend a little more time talking about?
Well, you have a bunch of my co-workers here. Veselin Hathout, Fabry, Demerov. I've already talked about a little bit about Nathan Edwards now this morning. And so I could say a couple things about these guys if you want me to.
Yeah, yeah.
Martha Veselin was, just to start at the top of your list, was a teaching in a four-year college and managing to direct undergraduate research, and she liked to come to the mass spectrometry meeting. And when I met her, she was ready to have a change in her life. You know, we're all supposed to change our job every 10 years or something. And so she came to UMBC and joined the NSF facility there. I guess I did say that when I left Hopkins, I was able to continue or renew or get a new NSF funding for a regional facility there.
Oh, okay.
So Bob and I both had NSF facilities for a while. We had different instrumentation and different clientele, so it worked okay. Anyway, Martha came as a senior scientist and was with us for 4 or 5 years. Was terrific. You know, maturity in the lab is always great. And did things like she made a book of the laboratory procedures, which, you know, I wasn't taking the time to do. When the NSF regional facility grants did have sunset clauses, as you may have known from Mike Gross, when the facility was ran out of its NSF funding, she spent a year at DuPont and then she's now the staff mass spectroscopist at the University of Wisconsin, and I don't know how many instruments she directs, but she, besides providing the measurements and occasionally collaborating with the faculty, she also does an enormous amount of training of graduate students, teaching them to use the instruments themselves. She's also been an international instructor in Malditov. She's given courses, I think, in this country, and she's been invited to several South American countries to teach, to give short courses in Malditov. So she's had a nice career. Is having a nice career of her own.
So how long did she spend in your lab?
I'd have to check, but I think it was 4 years.
Okay. Any other?
So you've got Fabry on this list. These are all, most of the names you've picked out are from UMBC. So Dan Fabry came as a postdoc from Italy turned out to be a really good experimentalist and did some beautiful early electrospray work on protein metal binding complexes in my lab. And then when I left UMBC, they, as I explained yesterday, they hired him and put him eventually on the tenure track faculty, and he became professor there through the last 10 years. And he moved a year ago to SUNY Albany, State University of New York at Albany. He had developed his own line of work at UMBC, studying protein RNA complexes, and he went to SUNY Albany to join a center for protein RNA complex interactions. So turned out to be a very good thinker as well as a very good experimentalist. Now,
I was just curious when you mentioned the fact that he was so good with in the lab. Did you find that various people who we interacted with had these kind of traits that some people you didn't really want in the lab, and some people you really encouraged to be in the lab?
I did have to let one postdoc go after 3 or 4 months. So, you know, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't.
Because of not being able to deal with the laboratory?
Couldn't carry out an experiment. Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, I assume, well, I guess they had something up here that they could rely on if they couldn't do lab experiments.
Well, not in that case.
And, no.
You know, I like to find out what a person's skills are and then let them go in that direction.
Okay.
And I learn a lot from them usually that way too.
So this particular person didn't really have the skills.
Perhaps. You know, I wondered how a PhD had been granted.
Oh, this is a postdoc.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some quiet inquiry suggested that most of his experiments had been done by someone else.
Mm.
I wasn't sure if his mentor knew that, but
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's certainly not a good thing to.
Yeah. So he needed to be out of science.
Yeah, it reflects poorly on the institution as well, though, that mm-hmm. he came from. So. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we don't want to go there.
Right.
But it is, I mean, you can spot them, I guess.
He wasn't spotted until he got to me.
Yeah, so but I mean, you did.
Yeah,
and
eventually.
You were... But
that was scary to fire a postdoc. So
yeah.
I actually called Fred McLafferty and said, you know, is it okay to fire a postdoc? He told me that sometimes it was good for the postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
But in one case in his lab, you know, he'd fire somebody and the guy had gone on to do well somewhere else.
And, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He encouraged me to do what had to be done.
Well, you go out to yourself as well.
And
if he's, the guy's not performing, then...
Yes. Yes.
But that's the only person, or you only have that one kind of negative experience.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I've dealt with 100 students and postdocs. So.
But that one sticks out.
That one sticks out, yeah. Then you've got Yitrib Hatut on... which is on your list, which is not the right way to say his name, but I never did get it right.
Okay.
He's from Morocco, educated in France, and I don't know if the name is Moroccan or French, but anyway, he was also a very gifted experimentalist and gifted thinker, had received his PhD in France in a cell biology lab, which used LCMS, and his professor there, in several cases I've been sent really outstanding people who weren't going to be given a chance in their in the country they were coming from.
Uh-huh.
Because Yitrib was Moroccan, his professor was concerned that he might not get an academic appointment in France.
Thought he deserved
an academic appointment.
There's a certain amount of pretension there.
And it still is.
Yeah,
the French can't decide if they're, how xenophobic they are. But anyway, so he came to me. He got off the plane without knowing really any English, and I pulled up the college French we were talking about yesterday, and he learned English very quickly. And he was really...
That had to be an interesting interaction where you're...
he turned out to be good at across the whole spectrum of science. You know, he could grow, he could culture cells, he could do chemical reactions, he could run mass spectra, he could use the computer, interpret data. And so I was just really pleased with him. He had to stay with me for some years. Maybe he was with me 6 years because... He took him a couple of years to decide he would try for a green card.
Uh-huh.
And then it took him a couple of years to get a green card. And so I benefited greatly from his presence in my lab. He helped train some of the other postdocs. And he now has a faculty position at George Washington University, and his laboratories are at Children's Hospital. So
uh-huh.
he's up to his ears in proteomics work. And
so this is, what was his name again?
Yetrib.
Yetrib,
and then his last name is...
Hatout.
Yeah. This is a pleasure for me to talk about these folks. Should I kind of keep moving?
Yeah.
You've got Plamen Demirev, and this is another scientific colleague who's, you know, had a big impact on my career and is also now a very good friend. Plamen was Bulgarian, and he got out of Bulgaria in the 80s, before the fall of the Soviet Union.
Mm.
But they let him out to train, they gave him permission to go abroad for 2 years for postdoctoral training, but they kept his wife and his newborn twins in Bulgaria to be sure he'd come home. And so, you know, his father had been a geologist. It was an academic family, and this is what he wanted to do. So he went to Gerasi's lab again. Gerasi was actually spent some of his childhood in Bulgaria, but again, Gerasi had this reputation for welcoming postdocs from everywhere.
Yeah.
So he spent a year in Gerasi's lab and decided that wasn't the right environment. And I don't know if Gerasi suggested it, but somehow he came to me next, you know, for the second year of his out of the country. Mm-hmm. He was and still is a terrific, very bright man, very hardworking, ambitious fellow. He'd been trained formally as a nuclear engineer, I guess, if you're, you know, in Bulgaria, that's what they let you do. And he liked mass spectrometry a lot. And he participated in some of the, what I was talking about, the building the intellectual foundation for working with larger molecules. Mm-hmm. When we were at Hopkins, and he and Bob and I co-authored the papers on the rates of fragmentation of heavier compounds, fragmentation rates as a function of mass.
Oh, okay.
You got that paper yesterday when we talked. It's Analytical Chemistry, 1987.
Okay.
So he went back to Bulgaria then, and they got him a new, I think, Hitachi mass spectrometer in the Academy of Sciences.
Oh, wow.
You know, intellectual structure. Based on the Russian system. So he did work there, was able to keep the mass spectrometer going pretty much on his own.
Yeah.
There was no hard currency to pay a repairman. And then I think that when the Soviet Union was falling apart, he moved his family to Sweden. And so he spent, 6 years, eight years in Sweden. Kids, formative years for his children. They speak Swedish and Bulgarian, French, German, and English.
Wow.
and then eventually decided that the family should come to America. And so once again, I had the opportunity to have him in the lab. And he came to me when I was at UMBC, and he was, you know, with an appropriate title, and was a big help, well, in research there, and particularly in the move to College Park.
Mm-hmm.
So he honchoed that move, and then spent a couple of years at College Park with me till he got his green cards straightened out, and now he's at the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, and we still write things together. We haven't worked together.
Yeah, I've seen there's something since 2001, 2002.
Those were written at College Park. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a 2008 review that where.
Yeah. Your mass spectrometry and biodefense, rapid characterization of market microorganisms.
Yeah. And so we're still good friends, even though we don't. Haven't gotten to do research actually together for a while. I'm fortunate in having really competent colleagues. I'll move down through your list. Ian Jarden. We should talk about Ian Jarden.
Yeah.
Okay. We talk about Ian Jarden for your microphone. I'll say we talk because he's a. His present title is Vice President for New Product Development.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right, at Thermo Scientific. So he's a very major force in the progress of mass spectrometry, and he's particularly led Thermo into biological applications. And so the course of science is being set by this to a large degree by Ian Jarden's decisions about new product development.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he came while I was still at Hopkins, came as a postdoc. This is another example where his mentor thought his career would be have more potential in America than in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
And so he was very smart, very hardworking. Had an adorable accent. All the ladies loved him. You know, he met and married his wife. He was at Hopkins in my lab. We published a again, exploiting what that new technology of GCMS with the selective ion monitoring. He published a number of the drug metabolism studies. And he then spent a couple of years at Purdue in the School of Pharmacy, and then a few more years at the Mayo Clinic. And he said that he was sitting in his office watching the snow fall one day, and Bob Finnegan called him and said, "Would you like to move to California?" And, so he moved. He joined the Finnegan Thermo Fisher Company and has been a leader there ever since.
Did he have any experience in mass spectra
yes,
before he
I
came?
Should, I'm glad you asked, because he trained with Ivor Reed.
Oh, okay.
Who was, you know, one of the
sure.
the generation of physical chemists or physicists who worked with mass spectrometry before it was a commercial instrument.
Mm-hmm. So it was he could step right in basically to your shop and be productive.
Sure,
because he had
yeah, we could learn from each other because
yeah,
he knew
yeah,
things
yeah,
I didn't, and
yeah,
probably
yeah.
vice versa. I have mentioned to you Michael Colvin, Michael Colvin, who was my oncology collaborator at Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
All of this early work on the cancer drugs has his name on the papers too. A wonderful technician in the lab who worked at Hopkins, and then is Sharon Palanti Morell, PALLANTEMORELL. She moved to. For most of her papers, her name on the papers is Palanti. She married late. She moved to UMBC with me and was the department manager there, left the lab to become the manager. And after I left UMBC, she stayed on and completed the renovation, a very extensive renovation of the chemistry facilities that I'd gotten started.
Mm-hmm. So she's kind of like become a principal investigator in her own right?
No, she was a staff administrator
okay.
in the department there, and now she's retired.
Mm-hmm.
But no, she moved to UMBC, left the lab, you know, left science,
okay.
as it were, but was responsible for quite a lot of the facilities development, teaching assignments, making the department function.
Work.
Yeah, so that was important. I wanted to mention a couple of, and I'm coming to the end of our list here, graduate students, because the list you selected didn't have any graduate students in it. As we just talked about yesterday, I did not have many graduate students at Hopkins, but one of my first graduate students there is also one of my most successful graduate students, Richard Van Breemen is his name. He is at the University of Illinois in Chicago, the School of Pharmacy.
Okay.
I mean, he got his PhD in the pharmacology department. And he runs a lab with about 20 mass spectrometers and a big group right now. And he's studied nutraceuticals, small molecules, which are not necessarily drugs, you know. And studied means sometimes identifying them, sometimes doing quantitation, sometimes correlating their abundances in collaborative clinical studies, just lots of LCMS.
That's what he is doing now.
Yeah.
Okay, because here he was doing some glucuronide work.
That's right. We were looking at not only making and characterizing glucuronides, but we demonstrated that they actually... some of them, these drug metabolites, are chemically reactive, and that the reactions they can carry out are not good for people, or alkylation of proteins, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a really great job of demonstrating that.
There's an outlier here. derivatives of dicyclopentadiene in groundwater.
You're good. Okay, my first interaction with the Army. What was it called? Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which was outside of Denver at that time.
Mm-hmm.
one of the chemists there asked me to get involved in thinking about some of the problems they saw coming on, which included their little ponds full of terrible chemicals leaking into the groundwater of the nearby communities.
Mm-hmm.
And they had probably made chemical warfare reagents there during the war, but after the war they let some of the companies come in and make pesticides on the grounds, and it was really the pesticides that were their chemical waste problem by the time I was working with them. So that paper with Richard is looking at what happens to cyclopentadiene, which is a starting material for some of the pesticides that were made there. What happens to it when it sits in the ground for some years?
Mm-hmm.
It's a small molecule, it's easy to analyze, and we actually identified quite a few metabolites, if you like to use that term.
So
I want to mention, by the way, that the fellow who engaged us in that effort was named Eddie Jones. He was an African-American, and gave my career a little bump, a little boost right then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a case where he came to you?
Yeah.
Okay. You're having people come to you frequently. You know,
I mean, was visible.
Yeah.
So he probably became acquainted with me either through ASMS or through an ACS lecture tour I did.
Okay.
I did some ACS lecture tours.
So, you know, there was this whole period when the environment was a big part of mass spec.
Sure.
You had come to the conferences, and environmental papers were like all over the place.
Yes.
You did some of it, but not. You didn't really get buried in that activity.
That's right. I was working at a medical school, so yeah.
And, okay. So, but you did do an. I mean, you had the tools to do.
That's right.
The thing. So it's a good. Okay. So, any other individuals that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I want to talk about another graduate student. This is one from UMBC. His name is Igor Kultashov. Kaltashov.
Okay. Yes, Kultashov. Got him here.
And I told you that I went to the international conference in Amsterdam in 1991, and that I met Victor Taurosa there,
mm-hmm.
and that I found this compound to use, the reference compound to use to measure the basicity of arginine at a post-succession.
Right.
And Taurosa was very interested in making U.S. connections, and so he invited me to be a visiting, I invited Bob and me to be visiting lecturers in FISTech, Institute for Physical Chemistry and Technology, in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent some time there, and the Russian physicists actually criticized my lectures for not being as quantitative as they were accustomed to. That's a fair evaluation. but no, usually my audiences don't complain about them not being quantitative.
Yeah. Interesting assessment there.
Taurosa wanted to, introduced us to the chairman of one of the departments at FISTech, as they call it, and they wanted to send some of their students to North America, and they said, would you rather have a postdoc or a graduate student? And Bob said postdoc, and I said graduate student. So Igor came, and I think I think he was pleased to be selected. I'm not sure he actually had a choice in the matter, but he was, of course, a brilliant student, and he was much more quantitative than most of our chemistry.
So that's
he came out of a physics training program.
That's a characteristic of the Russian worldview of science, is a super quantitative kind of thing.
This group that we fell in with, but at that, you know, before 1990, they gave national exams and directed the top 1% into physics, because physics constructs weapons.
You didn't have any choice.
I think if you didn't, if you wanted to be a physician, you got to go to Siberia. So there were a lot of Russian physicists in 1990 who really were interested in biology could apply this rigorous training, quantitative training, to entomology, and you know, they're all over our discipline right now.
Yeah.
As instrumentalists, as bioinformaticists, we're very, very fortunate, I think. And even Makarov, who invented the orbit track,
sure.
you know, comes out of that tradition.
Yeah.
So Kultashev came with a master's in physics, and UMBC let him TA the physical chemistry lab.
Oh, wow, there you go.
And I thought he was an outstanding TA. And, you know, and at the same time, he took the undergraduate organic course in order to take the undergraduate biochemistry course. You know, he kind of did a retread to broaden into
chemistry, biochemistry.
Did that, of course, very successfully and got his PhD.
So, but I mean, he had to be proficient in English.
Yes, he was.
And if he, was this part of, I guess, his training?
Yes. Well, you know, I believe by that, either they had already required the students to learn English or everybody got put on a crash course. So when we visited some of these secret science cities that are in a ring around Moscow, Tavrosa brought us into the one that he had was in charge of, we found that the older people were having daily English lunches. They were really serious. And, you know, we were able to help a little there.
What time period was this?
1991,
92. Yeah, early 90s.
Uh-huh.
But he came here in, like, 95. I see it while he's republishing stuff in 95.
I think that was probably 92.
And so, okay, so it took him a while to get his feet on the ground and get going with it.
And it took us a little, well, you know, I met Victor in 91. Then we did this return visit the arrangements were made. So,
how long were you there?
Just, I don't know, a month.
Okay, and so basically, you were like his guests.
Yeah, or guests of PhysTech.
PhysTech, and then they really wanted to show you the ropes.
He was very generous, and you know, we went in this previously secret science city, whose name I could get for you if it's important. We went to a machine shop that had like 30 stations for work, dirt floor. I don't know if that's better grounding or just, but there were only three or four people working there at that point. You know, things had fallen apart already. And they pulled cobalt rods in front of us.
Oh,
out of the water to show us some of their research.
Oh, we want to look at those, do we?
And, you know, some people we met there died of various cancers
in the next
couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, people seem to have a life expectancy of 50 who worked in these.
Cobalt sources are not all that nice to be waving around.
Yeah, and So anyway,
and the political environment then was, I'm not sure if I can characterize it, but I mean, basically,
fluid.
Fluid probably is the best way to put it.
And Tarosa, you know, was a very canny fellow who hoped to take advantage of the fluidity, and he did send his grandson to be trained here. Actually, a PhD student at Hopkins, and then eventually, as you probably know, Victor himself moved here. Died in California.
Yeah, that was fairly recent, wasn't it?
What I want to tell you about Kultashev. Okay, so he did was one of my best students at UMBC. We published a number of papers on the gas phase structures of peptides, and if you put two charges on them, the structure changed because the charges repelled. He postdoced with Bob at Hopkins, and that he now is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Oh, okay.
And still doing really nice work there. So I'm proud of both Van Breemen and Kultashev. I only want to mention two more people. You're being very...
No, that's
very
fine. I mean, you know, that's what we're here for.
One of them is Barbara Larson, who was a postdoc when I was at Hopkins, and I've had a lot of postdocs, but she stood out for a couple reasons. She is married to a man who works for Hewlett-Packard, not Agilent.
I think you're right.
And they have this nice house, you know, in the Pennsylvania, Delaware area. She finished her degree with Doug Ridge at the University of Delaware and wanted a postdoc with me. So she was going to drive down every day from work, and that usually doesn't work, but she seems very determined, so I said we could try it. And then she broke her leg.
No, she's coming to UMBC.
She's living with her, you know, she in Delaware.
And she's coming
to Hopkins. This is Hopkins, yeah.
Okay.
And she broke her leg, so that seemed like it was going to impair the drive. And she came by train every day and took a taxi to the lab. She did not make money this year, you know, did not mm-hmm. clear a profit in this mm-hmm. year. But she did it. She got there every day, and eventually the leg got better, and we could go back to driving down. But she was very determined to bring this off properly. Mm-hmm. And we have and she already knew, I think she was interested in going into industry. So we found a collaborator from, I have to check, one of the oil companies, not Exxon, but...
Okay.
He let us look at oil as a mixture. You know, this was in the NSF facility. Although it was in the medical school, it was okay to look at oil. We published, as Barbara did, the best we could with this new state-of-the-art MS-50 high-resolution uh-huh. sector instrument. Now, uh-huh. you know, since then, the Fourier transform time of ion cyclone resonance instrument resolution has taken over the oil
yeah.
field. But,
yeah.
but this was, you know, this was the start. It was an improvement over the low mass instruments. And
Yeah, my understanding is that the engineers back in England were working on trying to get it so that it had enough resolving power that it'd go reasonably high up in mass, maybe a couple hundred, and be able to resolve sulfur 32 from O2.
Yeah.
And that was one of the driving forces behind their push for increased resolving power, from what I gather.
Well, we certainly wanted to take advantage of both the increased mass range and the really improved resolution and apply it on another class. There are a bunch of samples that are classical hard samples
mm-hmm.
for
yeah.
chemistry
mm-hmm.
and refinery bottoms are certainly one of them. So that was Barbara Larson's success story, and she did get this nice job at DuPont, and mm-hmm. is still there, and a leader in the field.
Yeah, staying at DuPont seems to be a measure of some type of certain brilliance, because it's a tough environment.
Yeah, and they keep changing their business. They've changed their business plan dramatically in the last
year. Yeah, Simon Sick is another person, uh-huh. you know. I think
yes.
you probably know of Simon
Sick. Oh, sure.
He's managed to survive their whatever it is they do there yeah. to their employees.
He's another incredibly bright guy, too.
Yeah.
Well, so I think that DuPont has a couple of career tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara, I don't know about Bill Simonsek, but Barbara had gotten into the track where you could go through promotions parallel to management but
mm-hmm.
still be in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they call that, career scientist
mm-hmm.
or something. But anyway, so she's, and then of course you have, you know, additional responsibilities. She spent a lot of time in court for the company and
mm-hmm.
so on. Anyway, I was very proud of her as a postdoc. And the last person I want to comment on is Henry Fales, who was, I would not call him a mentor, but certainly a dear colleague. When I came to Hopkins and I got my first job, I didn't have it, I told you yesterday, I didn't have an instrument for 9 months or something. And I drove to NIH a couple times a week and used instruments there. And I used Hank's instrument, I used instruments in another division. With a man named William Landis and got some papers out, you know, despite not having an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So I have very kind personal feelings toward Hank, but I wanted to comment on a couple of things about him more generally. He deserves a lot of credit for getting NIH to fund mass spectrometry. I mean, I'm claiming that I was the first trained person in a medical school,
mm-hmm.
and there were a group out of Klaus's lab that also came into medical schools early. But I think Hank was involved in reviewing in discussions with the program officers there and convinced them, by his own work demonstrations, that this was going to be an important technique for biochemistry and medicine that they were interested in funding. And so he has always gotten a lot of credit as for getting funding to the external community. The other thing I want to say about Hank is that when ASMS started, lots of us were going to the meeting who weren't physical chemists, but we have to give, you know, Henry Rosenstock and Joe Franklin a lot of, and the other physical chemists who started the society, a lot of credit for setting up a really good constitution. I mean, the format of the meetings and the format of the constitutional, just so much better than many of the other organizations I'm active in. And one of the opportunities our constitution allows is nomination for officers. You know, there's a nominating committee. I'm sorry, petition nominations. Mm-hmm. To nominate by petition. So after a while, some folks decided that we needed to have more biochemistry on the board, just because there was a lot of growing use of the instrument in that area. And so by petition, we nominated Hank. Mm. And he ran, and he won, and he was the first biological person to be on the board. And he was a good person because he could joke with the physical chemists.
Oh, yeah, no, Hank was a wonderful guy.
And he's the incursion, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he came across as being very personable and threatening, and I mean, you didn't feel as though Hank was trying to pull some trick on you or anything, but he was... He was, in a sense, but in a very pleasant and kindly way, and trying to promote. I mean, it's the importance of guys like that, unfortunately, that was one of the people who I was supposed to interview.
Oh, you missed him,
I missed him. By probably what makes me a little unhappy, or maybe I shouldn't say this, but... I kept asking the board to give me direction.
Oh, yeah, to give you permission.
And finally, when they did, it was too late. If if they had responded when I initially asked.
Nailed him. Now, he was
it would have been a fantastic thing, and I know that...
he was really important in opening
the area. He is. And I'm glad that we were able to get part of that video
in from the symposium.
The CHF website on mass spectrometry. So
Well, I just wanted to say that. And then eventually there were some elected biochemists. You know, I was put on the board as a at-large member, and Jim McCloskey was elected into the presidential succession. But Hank was the first, and he was put on by petition. So, okay, I think that's all I was going to say. Now, are there any more names?
Well, I have
Well,
there's just a few. This one, I talked to the interview with Cy Marison. I see that you co-authored a publication with Cy on organic ions in the gas phase. This is in '70, so it's probably right after your.
He was still working then. Yeah.
Your organic, more organic-like. So how did you and Cy Marison get together on this?
I think he probably sought me out, as a result of ASMS presentations. But I was interested in my thesis. I put deuterium atoms in to study hydrogen, to track hydrogen transfers, and things like the McLafferty rearrangement. And he was also interested in that. And that paper, probably the paper you're looking at, has maybe 9 addresses on it. Has some
very large number. Cy and you and Young.
With the addresses.
Oh, the addresses. I don't have those. I don't have the paper.
It's
with
a
the
very
addresses.
Complex collaboration.
Well, yeah, there's the Landis. Selke.
He worked with me. Worked with.
Okay.
Another address.
Leitch.
Some of those are the old oil company guys.
Yeah.
So everybody seemed to have one labeled, is it aldehydes we're looking at?
Yeah, we're doing reactions of aliphatic aldehydes that are electron impact.
We need to get the front page of that paper to get the count the number of labs. Yeah. And Cy pulled this all together, and the reviewers, were kind about the paper, but they did say that they were quite impressed with the number of laboratories that we managed to coordinate to collaborate on this.
yeah. You know, I mean, it's interesting that Cy was able to do all this stuff in the petroleum industry. Mm-hmm. But it was, like I say, Joe Franklin and Field and Munson. These guys were doing really good basic science in the petroleum
industry. Cy was obviously a very smart man.
Yeah, definitely.
The other person we ought to mention is Jack Sharkey.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But I need to get you that picture. Jack was at what he worked for. A coal company instead of an oil company.
Yeah,
it was
a
in Pittsburgh, and he was very active in PitCon. He was a really, again, an advocate for mass spectrometry, and he made darn sure in those early years that there was mass spectrometry in the PitCon program, the Pittsburgh Conference program. He made sure that some of the mass spectroscopists got some of the awards, you know, and just worked on our behalf in his own quiet way.
Mm-hmm. I remember Jack from being the person who introduced me to the first paper I gave at PitCon.
Yeah, okay. Well, he probably arranged for you to give that paper there.
Probably.
Put you in the program.
Probably.
Yeah.
He knew I was, you know, barely dry behind the ears, so. He was very kind to me and, you know, made sure that I was comfortable about, you know, standing in front of this humongous group, because this was one of those early GCMS papers, and of course this was when people were all enthralled with what's happening there.
Right,
so the place was packed, and
So we need to, you know, we need to keep him on record as being an important
definitely
promoter in the early days.
Maybe if I get around to talking to Sandy someday, we can so actually there is one person that we probably should talk a little bit about, and he's not with us, he's not here right now. It's a guy by the name of Bob Cotter.
I talked to Bob, and we've decided, what I want to say about Bob, who, for your microphone, is my husband, is that it was a great pleasure to collaborate with him when we worked together at Hopkins, and it's been a great pleasure to live with him after we were married.
So, but I mean, you did have a little bit of a competitive, you know, like you say, when you left Hopkins, then there was, he kept the equipment, you had to get some, get your own. So
sure.
there was some kind of a.
Well, there's not a negotiation at the scientist level. The university has their rules. And the rules are that if NIH gave the money to buy the equipment to Hopkins or to Merrill, and then the university owns it, and you're allowed to use it. And as I said, about moving the Fourier transform instrument from UMBC to Maryland, that had been bought by DARPA, and it had a DARPA property tag on it. Mm-hmm. They'd actually not given it to the university, so they allowed me to move it. And then when I wanted to discontinue that instrument at Maryland, I had to get their permission to turn it off, and they tried very hard to find another lab for it. DARPA did. So that's an unusual situation. But anyway, Bob and NIH and NSF legally give the equipment to the university. So there was no bad feeling and no negotiation.
Okay, so it was just a matter of this is the way it is based on the...
Yeah.
So you two have had this exciting exercise of trying to get someone to dig around behind an instrument and find a property tag.
Well, we knew at Hopkins, I did have to prove at UMBC that there was a DARPA tag. But that was a smooth transition. And we have a little article in Rapid Communication which shows both our labs all together, because we do have lots of laboratory social events together.
Mm.
And when Bob got the distinguished award from ASMS last year, he funded a reunion of the two labs, of course Hopkins was a joint. All of our students were invited to this big party, so it extends their network too.
Sure. And that's a good network to be part of. I noticed that in Tanaka's lecture, Nobel lecture, at the end he acknowledges both you and Bob, and so there's a connection there that's obviously a little bit more than just random. You haven't been interacting with them, or
So we had, well, in Girasi's lab, I met a couple of Japanese postdocs, right?
Okay.
And those connections kept. We kept those connections, and then when they could, they started inviting me to speak in Japan, and then pretty soon they invited Bob and me to speak in Japan, and then somewhere in parallel with that, Bob Hopkins licensed some of Bob's patents to Shimadzu.
Okay.
Or to Kratos. They licensed some of Bob's patents to Kratos. Shimadzu bought Kratos, and then suddenly, you know, Bob was sort of a consultant to Shimadzu.
Yeah.
And that's not a secret. That's public information. But so we were in Japan for a conference, and somebody, I think it was Charlie Wilkins, told me I really needed to go to the Shimadzu plant and look at this fantastic instrument that somebody built there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, at the meeting we were attending, Tanaka's instrument, and at the meeting we were attending, Tanaka gave a poster, and Bob has this now famous picture of Tanaka with his poster showing the first protein ions over 70,000 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with this peculiar matrix he used, mm-hmm. but with his very well-designed time-flight mass spectrometer. And so when we came home from that meeting, I was supposed to go on to a desorption meeting in Munster, which came out of the Sims/Fab community.
Okay.
And I decided I'd done enough traveling and didn't go, but I thought that the work that Tanaka had reported at that conference was so exciting, so important. We thought it was so important that Tanaka had kindly given us small-sized copies of his spectra, and we faxed them to Munster to the meeting, and they were. And Benninghoven, the guy who organized the meeting, showed these spectra at that meeting. This is where Karas, according to Michael Karas, he and Franz realized they needed to go home and upgrade their mass spectrometer to see what they were actually desorbing. So anyway, because Tanaka knew that we'd made that connection of his work to to Europe, if you were,
yeah.
you know,
to a broader, bigger pond.
So I think we advocated his work after that. And so I think that's why he acknowledged Bob. The company was so disturbed by all this attention that they actually made him shut the instrument down.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to his lab, the instrument was covered with a drop cloth. I told you, maybe it was offline yesterday, I told you that the company didn't seem to have been very familiar with the Nobel Prize when he got it. So they're kind of taken by surprise by all of this. So we were supporters of his, and
we did
some advertising for him.
You did a good job of...
for science, I think.
Well, yeah, and also getting the work recognized in an area that, I mean, what would have come of it if, you hadn't promoted it?
Yeah, you know? I think that it would have taken a long time for Helen Kapp and Karas to think about the mass spectrometer. They were using a commercial instrument that Franz had actually helped develop, you know, and so he thought it was a good instrument and hadn't perhaps thought about that we might want to change it if we're really going to look for heavy ions.
But there's another interesting story with regard to fullerene.
Yeah.
In that I ran across a paper where the guys who did the work in the States, the original group that worked on the discovery of it, acknowledged that they had not been sufficiently aggressive in looking at the literature, because a Japanese researcher had actually proposed the structure a couple years earlier.
Ooh, it's not like got the Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah. Right. But they had the moxie, at least, or whatever, to actually call people's attention to the fact that if they had been more rigorous in their literature search, they would have discovered, of course, this was in a Japanese paper in Japanese and
that's
so on.
The problem, yeah.
But it was a theoretical description of you could quite, you know, there was a very possibility that C60 would form a stable structure.
Well, you know, things are rarely brand new in science. They always evolve from something. And we were fortunate that Tanaka's poster was in English, you know, because he wasn't that good in English at that time, and, and we could certainly understand it and get understand its importance. Actually, we were invited to the Nobel Prize ceremony. We each winner can make a list of 30 people, and most winners are academic, and they have all these students and postdocs. Previous students of postdocs. In Fenn's case, people who shared the patent, some of the patents with him, were invited. But Tanaka didn't have students of postdocs, and we asked if we could be invited. We figured, what the heck?
Yeah. Why not?
And we were invited. So you know, it's possible he added that just because we were there. But
well, it's like I say, I noticed it's little things like that that you kind of want to know a bit more about, because I mean, it's not that there's obviously an interaction there that would be valuable for both sides.
We like to say that we are Nihonophiles.
Ah, okay.
You know, we like Japan a lot. We like Japanese food culture people. My son was a East Asia Studies major at Harvard with a specialty in Japanese.
Okay, there you go.
he took my grandson to Japan last summer. So this is a genetic neonophile.
Oh, wow. So I wanted to spend just a little bit of time with regard to your name.
Okay.
Now, your maiden name is not Fenslau.
It's Clark.
It's Clark. Uh-huh. Okay. And so then you married Alan Fenslau.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So your public name is Catherine Fenslau.
I have one paper with Gerasi with the name Clark.
Ah,
okay. And then I have many papers with Fenslau. And so when we were divorced, you know, I just kind of kept the name professionally.
Yeah. By that time, it had been pretty well established in the literature.
Of course, Homeland Security got after me for using two names, so now my passport says Cotter, my bank account says Cotter, my tax report says Cotter.
Don't want to run afoul of those people. Most definitely don't want to get involved there. You have been involved in a number of organizations in your career. Both as working for them and also as being active in societies. So what has there been a fairly even-handed treatment of you as a woman in these various organizations, or is there some that have kind of you're a less than first class citizen? Or?
Well, you know, first of all, I should talk about ASMS. We talked yesterday that mass spectrometry was a new technology, at least new on a large scale, and that it had to welcome folks who weren't trained, there were people in it who weren't PhDs, who weren't formally trained in it, and those are the kinds of situations where women often get in on the ground floor. Computer science also. I did discover one woman who did mass spectrometry applications before me, and she was an employee, I think, at CEC, and there are probably some other ladies.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Who worked in the lab.
We're trying to get more information. It's too bad that we can't get more information about her, because I think she was very important in the development of their application of the instrument to protein petroleum analysis. So,
but anyway, I had no problem being received at ASMS, which wasn't ASMS.
No, it was ASTM.
Yeah,
which was
they sort of welcomed all comers.
Whatever. It was a happy-go-lucky group. they were pretty wide open.
And the physical chemists were, you know, outstandingly cordial. Henry Rosenberg, who worked at the Bureau of Standards near here, whom I could see recently.
Rosenberg or Rosenstock?
Rosenstock, thank you.
Rosenstock, yeah.
Was wonderful. Wonderfully cordial. But as I say, at the same time, Hank was making inroads as a biochemist. Biochemist. And so I didn't feel, so anyway, ASM is, I slid into without any hesitation. I think that the, I've been active, more recently in ACS, but, you know, more recently in ACS, they also, there's been, as more and more percentage of the chemists in the country are women, the ACS has less and less problems with, and I also should say that when Madeline Jacobs became the executive officer of the American Chemical Society, suddenly women started getting awards, and women were on the nominating committees and the selection committees. And
interesting.
So ACS opened up, and I think we have to give Madeline, although she's never would never admit it publicly, you know, credit for driving that transformation.
I saw her Thursday at the CHF activities.
Yeah.
She was there.
So ACS has opened up not just to me, but to two women in the at the awards level, which was where we and the, I was the founding president of US HUPO, so there was no problem there.
Tell me about this HUPO thing.
Let me say one more thing about whichever you want first.
No, you continue.
The time when I really did feel like there was some problem that might be because I was a woman was when I was submitting papers to a journal, and the papers, a couple of my papers in a row were rejected, and the reviews weren't that bad, and so seemed to be for emotional reasons they were being rejected. And of course, emotional could be for a lot of things. Maybe they didn't like the Hopkins address, but anyway, this was by an associate editor, so I finally got my nerve together. This is the most, you know, probably the only time I was ever this assertive. Called the editor-in-chief and said, I think you have a problem with this guy. He doesn't like my papers even though the reviews are okay. And the guy was resigned at the end of the year.
Oh, really?
The associate editor who'd given me so much grief was no longer an associate editor. And my papers always went after that, went into that journal smoothly. So that's a time where it might have been a problem. And I don't mean to be Pollyanna. There's probably I told you yesterday about my salary being 25% without comment. But there are probably lots of other things. But on the other side, though, sometimes the people beginning from Lyndon Johnson on 1960, people institutions thought they needed to have women on their committees and needed to have women up front. And so sometimes that you can get overworked because you're a woman.
Yeah.
We used to call that affirmative action-itis.
Yeah, action-itis, okay.
So it goes, it cuts both ways. Now, you were asking me about HUPO. So when proteomics, that term was first used by an Australian graduate student, I think in 1994.
And proteomics?
Yeah, but it's obviously it's a copy on genomics.
Yeah.
And very bright, aggressive man named Sam Hanash decided in the early 90s that we needed to develop proteomics differently. Probably lots of people decided we needed to develop proteomics differently than genomics. And the genome had been sequenced in a very limited number of labs, probably fewer than six. The public sequence was done completely in American and British labs. And all these other countries were really angry because they didn't get a piece of that action for prestige reasons.
Sure.
Even if they got access to the sequence. And for a little while, they didn't get that wasn't open, but now it is. So they decided to try to make an international organization and make sure that the proteome effort was more widespread. And so I give Sam Hanash credit for leading the founding of the International HUPO Organization.
How do you spell his name?
H-A-N-A-S-H.
Okay.
And it's S-A-M-I-R. He's Lebanese, I think. But he works at...
So HUPO
stands... He was at Michigan, University of Michigan, and now he's at an institute in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so HUPO was founded.
And it stands for?
Human Proteome Organization.
And okay.
Then they, you know, we did realize not shortly, that there are going to be other interesting proteomes, you know, plants, bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
It would probably, the mission statement says, you know, at associated proteomes or something. But but the idea was to try to spread it out a little
better.
So
this is a fairly recent development.
Yeah. I think we're having our 12th meeting in Boston.
Okay. The U.S. So the U.S.
No, international.
There's an international cupola.
It rotates between three geographic sphere parts of the globe.
Uh-huh.
And it was in, well, you know, so it's in Korea, it's in China, it's in Japan. It will be next year in Japan. Last year it was in Switzerland. And this year it's in Boston.
Okay.
And I'm actually on the planning committee for that. But
And then there's the U.S. HUPO, which is kind of like a
national, a subsidiary. Yeah. So, you know, you can't, we like to talk to people that are closer, that are more accessible. So each country has its own proteomics organization. And the nice thing about U.S. HUPO is it has about 600 people.
Yeah, I was wondering about the size of this.
The way you and I remember ASMS.
Yeah. It's fun to go to because you know the rest of the people,
yeah.
And it's, you're not being run over by a bunch of other people.
Yeah, exactly.
And, all right, during your career, the women's movement kind of came into on the scene. Did you ever feel, I mean, you never really identified with that, I don't think.
I was too busy doing science.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I benefited from it. I had a note here to myself to tell you that I had good fortune several times in my career. First, I think Sputnik is good fortune, that the government was very enthused about supporting the training of scientists and began to include women. The equal rights legislation that Lyndon Johnson signed, Title IX, so that's how I got my big raise. and that was important for women in my generation. And I told you a lot of my college classmates got into law school after that. Mm-hmm. And then I have to admit that the women's movement was beneficial to me. I didn't deny it, but I was pretty busy doing what I thought was my part for it. Just general sensitization. And I got in the 1980s, I received the, in 1985, I think, I received the an award from the American Chemical Society, which is given to women chemists. And so there was a big debate at that time in CNE News and other places about whether they should even continue this award because it was for women chemists only. And I, when getting ready for this discussion with you, I reread the talk I gave when I got that award, accepted that award. And I had made the argument that we had to make the point somehow that there was good science being done by women, but that the organic division gave an organic award, and there were like 16,000 women in ACS and 11,000 organic chemists and 6,000 physical chemists, and the organicers had an award, the physical chemists had an award, so, you know, the larger group probably deserved an award.
Yeah.
You can make some kind of argument for it.
Yeah.
That award has thrived. It's still being given by the ACS.
Okay, excuse me, dear. I look here. And did you ever feel, you had a family, so this is the field was took a lot of energy to keep your career in focus and raise kids. So was that a...
Well, I really wanted to have a family, and I think that's an important part of my being a role model, is that I'm a scientist with a family. When I was at Berkeley as a postdoc, I became aware of a female scientist who was a professor in, I think, the microbiology department, who had four kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, you know, a terrific role model. It could be done. It could be done. Now, what I didn't know was that she had a babysitter for those four, or a nanny or something for those four kids. And I did, in fact, Alan and I had a full-time, had a 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. babysitter, not a live-in, but anyway, the same lady, same nice Irish family, and she had four daughters, so we had built-in babysitters, mm-hmm. evening babysitters mm-hmm. if we needed them. That worked okay for the kids. I was disappointed that my children did not want to be in science. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that yesterday. Mm-hmm. They thought we worked too hard at it. We loved it too much, and so we told them that was okay if they weren't in science, but that they should. We hope they found something that they were passionate
about. Sure.
About,
yeah. Know. Yeah. Yeah. I guess our attitude as well. So you were very active in the American Society for Mass Spectrometry. So how do you see that organization having changed from when you became a member, and then through actually holding responsible positions in that society, and today?
Well, it's gotten remarkably strong, and it's a very important leader in science more broadly than just in mass spectrometry. And I have to give the physical chemists who wrote the Constitution, again, a lot of credit for envisioning the kind of organization that would endure and would strengthen. I think it was very important that we hired Judith mm-hmm. Watson Schoberg. Mm-hmm. I was on the board at the time, and I didn't understand how important a professional manager, that's not quite the right word, but staff could be.
Yeah.
Bernie Munson was the last program chair who pasted up the program himself.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first program chair who didn't have to paste up the program, so that, I think that was a very important decision, and it's been good for Judith too. She has a whole company now and manages several organizations. So I've been really very pleased, and I'm pleased that it's moved on to generations. Who don't have anything to do with the fact most of the physical chemists have passed on, and mm-hmm. even if I call myself a second generation, we're not leading the organization anymore either. Mm-hmm. But there are very energetic, enthusiastic people in charge, and the board structure is really good because it generates a balance and a variety of ideas. And the fact that they meet in person is really important. I hate conference calls, and I watch some of these some organizations evolve so that the professional manager is actually making the decisions.
Yeah,
decisions.
And see where that could happen, particularly in a conference call situation.
Yeah. So I think that I'm delighted that it continues to be strong. I don't mind that it detracts from PitCon. I struggle with the fact that it pulls a lot of good science out of the American Chemical Society meetings, but those meetings are so large and in so many different hotels anyway, that this is we have a lot of fun at ASMS. I love having the elevator door open and three people come out that I knew and haven't seen for a year, and being in one site was of course a nicer situation than what we now have, but we'll see what happens. It would be okay with me if it leveled off, if attendance leveled off for a while. But that's apparently not even happening in Canada.
Apparently not. I mean, mm-hmm. I think there was some concern at last year's conference being away from the East Coast, which is such a dense population of people who would attend the meeting, and being in Denver. Mm-hmm. And I think the attendance was a little bit less than the previous year or the previous 2 years.
Bad economy too.
Well, that's the other thing. But I mean, given the state of the economy, I think everybody felt the attendance in Denver was good. it didn't drop off really significantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just
I didn't notice any fewer people.
It was just, I think it's maybe 100 or so less.
Yeah.
If they're sold out all their hotel rooms in Vancouver, then mm-hmm. There'd be people coming from the Far East to attend. And my sense is it's still, it is an international meeting, even though I know that the board and everyone else wants to keep that phrase out of the name of the society in the meeting. But it is international.
Yes, and I'm proud of that too. that I think that most of the Europeans who come are, in fact, postdocs. The hair professors don't come unless they're especially invited, but at least those postdocs will grow up thinking that's a good meeting to go to.
So we served on the board together for a while, and from that period, I'm trying to get a recall what the size was back then. It was not nearly as big of an operation as it is now. It's probably, we got much more than 1,000, 1,200 people or something like that back then. I don't know. Do you have the numbers there?
No, I don't have any numbers there. We've handled that growth somehow. I think probably.
I remember this kind of tension. Well, do we want to get bigger or do we not?
Have any control over this?
Yeah, we don't have any control over it. And you know, if you get bigger, it's more work and harder to make it the meeting, the collegial type thing that you would like it to be when we had 500-600 people. But then on the other hand, do you want to get smaller because that means that the discipline is being, you know, falling by the wayside? So it's like, okay.
Well, one of the things we have lost by becoming big is there's no more an effective conference dinner or conference party because there's just too many people to have in one space. And
Effectively.
Yeah, effectively. And I think we didn't even try it in Denver last year.
I think that's correct. I think that Judith wasn't able to find anything that seemed to be appropriate. And with that size of a group, it's really hard unless there's something that's very specific to that particular area. That you know, like I think when we were in Seattle and went to the Boeing's
aerospace
museum, that was I think a good event because that was a unique place, and it had a very interesting setting, and I think it worked well. But if you can't find something like that in an area, then I think you're...
Well, we take you out to Fort McHenry today. Maybe we should... You can think about whether that would be a good thing for the group to do here.
So when are they coming here?
14.
Okay. So I think they're going to come to St. Louis either after that or... I guess after
so
that.
So we're going to be in Minneapolis
13, next year.
And then Baltimore.
Baltimore in 14, and then I think St. Louis in 15.
Well, St. Louis will be fun. We've been there once.
I think there might have been one way back in the past. I've got the list.
I tried to go through the arch and failed for some reason.
Well, let me see. Let me look at my little list of things here and make sure that we've gone.
I'm checking all mine too.
All the items that. Well, I don't have any additional...
You asked me last night about, when we were not recording, about undergraduates, and I could just say...
Yes.
First, let me say that the name of the ACS award given to women is Garvan Medal.
Garvan.
And just for your... whoever tries to make sense out of this.
Yes.
Okay, so undergraduates. I think that scientists feel that they're obliged... to try to get younger people interested in science, part of our responsibility to science. And I haven't done very much in K-12 myself, but I have always had undergraduates in the lab. I've always had a small number of undergraduates in the lab because they really do require a lot more attention from somebody than a graduate student, or certainly than a postdoc. But they can be quite productive, and I've always tried to choose undergraduates who were going to be PhDs rather than physicians or dentists, because I thought their motivation would be better. The woman we have right now in the lab, who you briefly encountered yesterday, is a freshman, and I hope she'll work with me for 4 years. She's very bright, she's very conscientious, she's very interested in science. We're trying to get her funding from some of the mini programs that College Park has for undergraduate research. Her family is a Chinese American family who own a bakery in Wilmington. So she brings us great goodies.
There you go.
At holidays, inappropriate holidays.
There's a certain advantage there.
That's right. take advantage of all our connections, yeah.
Now, you did mention that you only take on one of these individuals at a time.
Yeah, at College Park I've taken on one at a time, yeah. I may have had two on occasion at UMBC. But, yeah, that's just because getting them started requires such an investment of personnel time from the laboratory. You know, they could hurt themselves.
Oh, yeah.
If they're not carefully instructed and carefully kept an eye on. And
yeah.
And
this was an issue with my son Matthew at Northwestern when he uses a fridge. You know, one of these things. He does this condensed phase matter physics stuff where you got this super ultra low temperature.
Yes.
And there was a problem with the equipment, and someone could have gotten seriously hurt. If they'd made the wrong move, and he really, when he found out basically the thing wasn't working, they were trying to fix it. When he found out what they were doing, he hit the ceiling and bang, you know, you have to, you have to tell me about these things.
Oh, yeah.
You have
to
keep me informed, and because you could have, you know, literally, killed yourself with the.
Well, that's a good point. When something goes wrong, I should better
say. Yeah. I mean, if, you know, maybe you did cause it to go wrong, maybe you didn't, but whatever. You need to report it to someone who knows, understands the equipment,
Well, that's a good example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And the issues in my lab would be a little different than that, but still. You know, we're talking about high-voltage instruments.
If you get hurt seriously, and it's something that is important. And I think the idea of taking only one at a time is probably smart, because the last thing you want to do is have something happen that's untoward. Okay, I think I probably exhausted you with this conversation.
Well, this has been more fun than I thought it would be, Mike.
Oh, good. Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with this, is have fun. I don't want to make this into an onerous task or anything. So.
Sure.